Margaret and John Peyton lived in the 1800s. And these two people followed Jesus, and they had a real deep burden in their hearts for an island very far away from their home, which at that time was called the New Hebrides, but today is called Vanuatu, just northeast of Australia. And at that time, it was a lot of colonialism going on, and many people were going into that island for various reasons, and some of them, not such nice reasons. But John and Margaret felt that they needed to go and tell these people about Jesus so that they too could know who Jesus is and know the gift that he could give to them. So off they went. They packed up, left everything, and went over there. But when they got there, they realized they did not have a very warm welcome. They found that the indigenous peoples of the islands did not trust them. And probably rightly so, because there were so many people coming and going for various reasons, to take advantage of their resources and for various other reasons. But John and Margaret thought to themselves, we will stay here, and over time they will see, by our love for them, that we have nothing, we have no ulterior motives but to bless them. And so they stayed, and so they stayed, and so they stayed. But the indigenous people continue to dislike them and not want them to be around. And all of this came to a head one night when the people of the village had enough. They thought, today's the day, we are going to kill off this couple. So the chief and all his warriors got together with all their weapons, and off they marched towards the house. How do you think John and Margaret felt that night? They were the only two in the home. There was nobody else around, and they could see the people coming towards them for the purpose of killing them. They were probably extremely desperate that night, and they probably prayed the most desperate prayers of their lives. And they prayed, and they prayed, and they prayed. It was a night of terror as they anticipated their door being crashed down at any moment. But hour after hour as they prayed, the door did not come down. And then the sun started to come up, and then they started to hear the regular noises of a village waking up. That was odd. Very strange. What happened? They peered out their windows. They eventually probably got enough courage to open up their door and step outside. There's nobody around. Just the regular village people doing what they did on a normal day. There was no sign of the chief. There was no sign of any of the warriors. What had happened that night? John and Margaret had to wait a full year to actually find out the full story of what took place that night. Because in this year, as they stayed there and as they loved the people, eventually the chief himself started to listen to them and say, what they say makes a lot of sense. I think I want to follow Jesus too. And so he did. So that chief went from enemy to friend. And about a year later, John and this chief were talking together, and they got on the topic of what happened that night when you guys were all coming to our house to kill us, and nothing happened, you just left. And the chief said to John, John, what are you talking about? Did you not see those thousands of men around your property shining with swords in hand? And John said, no, it was just my wife and I, just the two of us. There was nobody there. There were thousands of men, and they were all surrounding your property, all of them with a drawn sword. We were terrified, so we left. This was a night when they went from terror to euphoria, knowing what God had done. Now, this is an example that happened in the 1800s. But as we heard through the reading of the word this morning, we have an example of this way back, centuries back, with Elisha, the prophet. And as was read to you, king of Aram was in battle with Israel, and they had their battle plans. But Elisha, who was walking so closely to God, would have these conversations with God. And God would tell him, hey, by the way, Elisha, the king, they're setting a stronghold right here. You might want to advise your king to avoid that area. So whatever was being planned, whatever war plans were being had, Elisha would find out because God would tell him. He would inform the king, and then they would avoid that area. So Aram, of course, thought there was a traitor in the midst. But when he found out it wasn't, and it was Elisha, he was determined to kill him. And off he went. Elisha, who had a servant, woke up the next morning and saw that the hill was covered with people, with armies coming towards them. A very similar example, an example of terror and fear. What is going to happen? We are going to be killed this night. And Elisha, so calm, just no problems, cool as a cucumber that night, and said, don't worry, those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And Elisha prays and asks God to open the eyes of this servant. And God does. And then he sees an army of firing chariots along the hillside protecting them. These are great stories. And we kind of feel, wow, that's the kind of life I want. I want that God in my corner. That whenever I'm facing something, he's going to swoop in with a huge army and protect me. We've been talking a lot about the names of God in our summer series. And each name represents a characteristic of God. And today we're going to talk about the Lord of Sabaoth, which is the Lord of hosts, or the Lord of armies, which indicates and gives us this picture of an army, a leader, someone who is extremely, extremely powerful. And so we saw that Elisha and the Peytons trusted God, and God came through for them. So the question I ask is, where do you find courage when you feel surrounded, outnumbered, or overwhelmed? Maybe for children, your fear is that of fitting in at school. For some of you, you may fear the fighting that's going on in your house, and you're concerned and worried if your parents are going to divorce. There's so many things you will fear. For older children, you may be fearing cyberbullying. You may be worried about what's going to happen in school, what courses to take, and all those things that concern school. For yet older people, you may be wondering, what's going to happen with my life? Will I find a good job? Can I find a good, healthy relationship? We all have fears. We all have worries. Those who are older may be fearing what's going to happen to their elderly parents or what's happening with their children. And then when we move on into our senior years, we may fear the end of life for us. What's it going to look like? I'm losing my independence. I'm losing my abilities. And on a world scale, we fear wars and conflicts that are going on. We fear climate controls and political polarization, economic uncertainty, inflation. We have so many fears. So we too can trust in the Lord of hosts, Yahweh Sabaoth. You'll notice on this slide that there's a little note for children. So adults, you can just ignore it. The children, you have little packages to follow along. So when you reach this slide, you can go into your first activity. Let me tell you a little bit about this Lord Sabaoth. I have an image here on the screen for you. And it's an image that depicts the three heavens. Now, whether the heavens look like this exactly or not, we don't know. But the idea in Scripture, as we've once heard Paul say, that God took him to the highest heaven. And there are many references of the various heavens. And the most high heaven is where Jesus dwells. So the first heaven at the very bottom is this world that God created. He created it for us and gave us the responsibility to steward this world. This world is limited by time and space. It is subjected to physical properties, natural rules such as gravity. And we can't see beyond this world. We see what's in here. We interact with this world through our five senses, and that's the way we interact with it. We cannot see beyond, with our physical eyes, what's outside of our time and space. So we are limited. But yet we have a lot of autonomy in this space. The second space, or the second heaven, would be a space where it's a spiritual world, where the angels of God and demon and his angels will occupy this space. And this space is operated by spiritual principles. And what happens here can affect what happens in our world, our physical world. But above all of these powerful creatures that we ourselves in our own strength cannot stand up against, we have God, the Most High God, the Most High Heaven, where God reigns. God lives there with myriads and myriads and myriads of angels who are worshiping him day and night. Those who have followed Jesus are also there. This is heaven, the most powerful place. And what happens there affects what happens in the second world and in the first. We kind of like this idea of a God who's supreme and all-powerful, who can take care of us. Similar to the experiences we saw in Elijah and in the Peyton's life, where God comes in a miraculous way and defeats the enemy, and defeats the evil that they're facing. But what we don't like, sometimes, humans have difficulty with that supremacy, because we want a little bit of control. We like it when God is there to protect us, but whoa, when God is totally supreme and holy, he's not going to put up with any sin. There is no sin in heaven. And if God himself came into this room today and we could feel his presence, the building would probably shake. In the Old Testament, when the Israelites were journeying through the desert, and God came into their presence, the entire mountain was shaking. We'd be shaking in our shoes because we cannot contain the power of God. But yet, we want to have that power. That was the problem with humanity, where we did not trust God enough to say, "You're supreme." We felt God was holding something from us, and we want that control. We kind of like the idea of a God who we can call upon, like a vending machine. You go to your vending machine, you put your money in, press the buttons, and out comes what you want. That's the way we want to treat God. We go to him when we have something, when we have a need, and then we walk away from him. And otherwise, we want to be in control. However, God Sabo is not only that powerful God who will defend us, he's also a holy God who demands holiness from us. And the reason why we think that is because we feel in our world that might is right. And that's the way our world operates. The army with the stronger weapons will win. The person with the louder voice will probably get their way. The people with power and money can do what they want because they've got the power and the money. That's the way our world operates. But that's not how God operates. God does not operate like that at all. Okay? In fact, God is very different. So if God was a power that we couldn't understand, or something to be feared that we did not know and we thought to appease, we would have fear, and rightly so. But this God who holds all supremacy is a God we can trust. How do we know that? Because he created this world as a beautiful place. And he gave us the power to rule it. So we had lots of autonomy. And the only restriction he gave us was not to eat of the fruit of good and evil. Because he knew that in our limited human state, we could not handle the responsibility of determining what is good and what is evil. God is the author of good, and he sits in heaven, but a place of all goodness. So the reason why this was a perfect world was because God was supreme. Humans had autonomy, but they had a perfect relationship with each other, with creation, and with God. But God was supreme. Adam and Eve were tempted at this time, and the temptation was, did God say, putting the doubt in their mind, is God really good? Does he really deserve all that power? Should you not be sharing that power with him? And at that point, sin entered our world and broke that relationship we had with God. So at this point, I guess God could have had three choices. He could have taken humans and said, forget you guys, and smashed up the world just like someone may smash up a Play-Doh creation they've made and start again. He could have said, okay, you don't want me? I'm turning my back on you. It's yours. All yours. I'm not going to have any part of this world. You do what you need to do with it. And if that was the case, we'd probably have been killed ourselves off centuries ago. But instead, right there at that point of the broken relationship, of the broken world, a world where death came in, God already gave them a promise that he would redeem this world. And he set a plan up to redeem the world. Later, Jesus shows up on the scene, which is the climax, the pinnacle of that plan. Fully God, fully human, Jesus comes to this world to show us who God is, to show us the power that he has. When Jesus lived on this earth, he had power over the wind and the waves. He had power over everything, but he willingly submitted himself. At one point, he said, I could call for 12,000 legions to come and help me when he was facing his death, but no, he did not. He surrendered to that death, and he died on the cross. And what happened here at this point, what the enemy thought was their greatest victory, ended up being their greatest defeat. Because Jesus died, but he rose again, which means he defeated death. So the death that entered our world is now defeated. It's gone. And God opens up a place for us to be able to communicate with him. The way to heaven is now open. So that means even though we're here on the bottom in the first world, we can zip up to the third, the very highest heaven, to talk to God. And our prayers make a difference. Our prayers, when we're in the throne room of God, does control what's happening in the second world with the angels and the demons. God has given us the power to pray against the powers of evil. God has given us the power to pray, and the angels will come and help us through our prayers. So he's given us the way. We're not stuck at the bottom anymore. We have that relationship with him. But he is going to come back to us with a promise. And that when the final promise is fulfilled, all evil will be gone. Death will be defeated completely forever and ever and ever and ever. All of it will be gone. And then we will come back to a place where we started, a perfect world with God as in supreme control, but with us autonomy and having a loving relationship with him. So when you see that God does not operate on the might is right principle. He operates on a very, very loving, loving, loving relationship with us. With such deep love he has, he restrained that power for our good to give us. And now he expresses that power, and we can share in that power with him. But here's the other thing, too, we have to remember, that the God who has all this power deserves reverence. Sometimes we can become quite casual with God. And we forget how holy he is. He does want us to be in deep, deep relationship with him. But at times, we forget his holiness, and we forget that he requires reverence. He requires our accountability. So let me tell you a little story about Elijah and Gehazi, which is recorded in the Bible in the book of 2 Kings. There's a man named Naaman who's a Syrian, and he has leprosy. And he comes to the prophet Elisha and says, hey, can you heal me? Elisha tells him to go and dip himself in the water 7 times. And he does. And his leprosy is completely healed. So this Syrian is so grateful and thankful and wants to give Elisha some gifts. Elisha, please take these gifts. I'm so grateful for what you've done. I'm so grateful to your God for healing me. I'm going to follow your God. But here, take these gifts. I want to say thank you for what you've done. And Elisha says, no, I will not receive your gifts. The power of God is not something for me to benefit from. I'm not going to receive your gifts. So Naaman goes off, gets onto his chariot, and away he goes. Gehazi, on the other hand, who's Elijah's servant, thinks to himself, now, why did Elijah do that? Look at this guy. Look at what he's got. Look at what he wants to give us, money and beautiful clothing. I'm going to go after him, and I'm going to get that stuff for myself. So he hops on his horse, chases down the party, and then when he gets to there, Naaman steps down and says, oh, what is it? What is it? Gehazi makes up some type of a lie so that he can also get the gifts. So Naaman gives him the gifts, and off he comes. He comes back home, and he hides them where he lives. And then Elisha says to him, Gehazi, where have you been? Nowhere, nowhere. And then Elisha says something to him. "Was not my spirit with you when the man came down off his chariot?" You see, Gehazi was not just any man. He was Elisha's servant. He saw Elisha day in and day out. He saw the great things that God had done for him. The miracles that were performed through Elisha, through the power of God working through Elisha. He should have known better. He should have known that probably Elisha would know. I mean, he was probably around when Elisha was able to see the battle plans of Aram. So there's an accountability here. Elisha says to him, "The leprosy that was on Naaman will now be on you." There is accountability. Sometimes we live in Christian circles and we get used to the Christian language, we get used to the Christian routines, and then our hearts may not be in it. We just kind of go along with the flow. And we think we can hide a secret life. We think we can live one life in the presence of the people of God and one life that's when we're on our own. And this story tells us that we can't. The great Yahweh Sabaoth, who has all power, does demand reverence and does expect accountability for us. There's another way that we can really, really, really get a wrong idea about who this God Sabaoth is. And this can be shown through the story of Joshua 5. So this is the night before Joshua and his army are going to attack, I just forgot the name of the town. Jericho, thank you. They're going to attack Jericho. And the night before, Joshua's by himself, and he sees this vision of a man with a sword, glowing man, and he realizes that this is a spiritual being. So he asks him, "Are you friend or foe? Are you for us or are you against us?" And the person says, "Neither. I am the commander of the Lord's army." See, sometimes we feel that God is for us, to help us, to protect us. And sometimes we almost think that those who are followers of Jesus are the in-group and those who are not are the out-group. And we treat them like that. Okay? And this is saying, no, I'm not for you, I'm not for them. I'm from the commander of the Lord's army. And what was Joshua's response? Joshua fell on his face to the ground in reverence. "I am in your command. What do you want your servant to do?" And the commander of the Lord's army said, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy." So this whole question about whose side are you on is now irrelevant. Do you not see, Joshua, that God is so holy, the ground where you are standing, you need to take off your shoes? So yes, the Lord of Sabaoth is there to protect us, but he also demands our reverence because he is so holy. It's not a question of serving me and the outsiders are not served. God is here for everybody. God loves everybody. But we tend to think that since we're on the inside, we have special privileges with God. But God loves everybody. And here's the hardest part. God of Sabaoth does not always answer prayers the way we want them to. Let me tell you a little bit about the story of John and Betty Stamm. Now, these people lived in the 1900s, and John and Betty Stamm went to China. And their purpose in China, again, similar to the Paytons, was to tell the people there about Jesus. But during this time, there was a lot of civil unrest going on in China. There were communist rebels around, and life was a little bit on the dangerous side. And they wondered, should we leave? They had a 3-month-old little baby named Helen. Should we leave was the question. There were rumors going around that rebels were coming to attack, but no one really understood or really knew what the truth was because the rumors just kept going and tangling themselves up with each other. The magistrate of the area guaranteed his protection over John and Betty and said, "You'll be protected from the communists." That's a lot of comfort. That's great. They probably felt quite comforted with that. But as time went on, it came to the point where they could no longer make the decision whether or not to flee because the rebels were upon them. They attacked the town where they were, and their intent was to get rid of all foreigners and all Christians. So Betty and John were taken that day. Their door was kicked down, and they were taken away with their little child. They were put in a hut overnight, And in that night, I'm not sure exactly how they felt, but I do know they were at peace. Because this is what he says. John writes to the mission. He penned a letter informing them that Betty were in the hands of the rebels. The Lord bless and guide you. And as for us, may God be glorified, whether by life or by death. And he gave this to a Chinese postmaster to deliver. And that person asked him, where are you going? He says, we don't know where they are going, but we are going to heaven. They had great peace in that time of difficulty. You could imagine yourself in that situation. You have a 3-month-old child, and you're wondering, is this the last day of our lives? What's going to happen to this child? Is this the way our lives are going to end? Well, for John and Betty Stamm, that is what happened. That night, their lives ended, and their child was an orphan. And you hear that, and you think, no! That's not the way the story is supposed to end! Where are those armies that should have come in and protected them? It didn't happen in this case. But even in that tragedy, we see the fingerprint of God. We see that the little child was miraculously taken care of. And then later on, she was taken to family members who raised her. We see through their death, it had such an impact on the people, not only in China, but around the world, that from their death, when they had memorials back in the United States, there was about 800 young people who stood up and said, I will take their place. I will go abroad and tell people about Jesus. Their story was published in secular media, and when people read it, they said, how can this be? And that story so touched their hearts that they became believers of God. Now, we don't know exactly why, because, again, we live in this bottom tier in our world, which is limited by time and space. We don't understand the complexities of what's happening in the second world and in the highest heaven. But we do know we have a God we can trust. We do know we have a God that's good. We do know we have a God that only does what's good for us. We do know we have a God who has a plan, and the plan is to redeem this world back to him. It may not always look the way we want it to. In the Peyton's case, it was so exciting to see that story. Wow, they got rescued in such a miraculous way. But in the Stamm's case, it wasn't. But it's the same God who's in control. And see, that's where we sometimes have trouble. It's that control. We want that control for ourselves. It's hard for us to surrender to a God who we don't always understand the decisions he makes. But this God will give you courage in the fear, whatever fear you're facing. He will give you the provision you need, whether it is a miraculous deliverance or whether it's not. He will give you the courage to go through the difficult times of your life and our life as a world. But the problem is sometimes we shrink God down completely. We shrink him down and we don't know. We don't know that he can actually do this stuff to us. Maybe he did it back in those days, but he's not going to do it for us. Maybe he's going to answer somebody else's prayer, but not my prayer. Maybe you're like me and you think, God, I just haven't seen it. Day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, I'm praying for certain things and there's no change. There's no change. It just seems like evil keeps winning. Why is that? Your prayer may be, Lord, open up my eyes so that I can be encouraged and see what you are doing. Because ultimately what God is doing is to redeem the world to himself. He loves us. He cares for us. He will deliver us. And if he doesn't deliver us in this world, he will give us the courage to go through what we need to go through. There's nothing on this world that can't be redeemed by God. I wouldn't say it was God's will that John and Betty died, but that evil was turned for good. So I'd like us now to just take a little bit of time to do some reflection. I'm going to have some reflection questions on the screen, and I'm going to ask the prayer worship team to come up. And we're just going to end today with a bit of silence, wanting you to reflect over these questions in your own personal life. Where have I shrunk God down to a manageable helper rather than worshiped him as the Lord of armies? The Lord of armies, all we can do is fall down and worship him. But sometimes we just want to be the person on the ladder and say, God, please pass me the screwdriver. God, please pass me the hammer. We don't understand that he's the Lord of armies and we need to worship him. Does the holiness of God produce reverence in me, or have I become casual with his glory? Sometimes we become too casual with God's glory. And then there's a third question. Where do I need courage because the Lord of armies is not absent from the fight? It may seem like he's absent and you're worried and you're concerned, and God, where are you? And it's okay to cry out to God like that. But maybe that's where you are. But remember that God is not absent from the fight.